November 9th, 2024 marks 35 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall. The dramatic end of the wall, a symbol of the tensions between East and West, communism and capitalism, served as a climax to what became known as the revolutions of 1989, the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. 13 months later, the Soviet Union would be dissolved, ending a 69-year experiment with communism. Through this podcast series, Over the Wall, Remembering Life Behind the Iron Curtain, through interviews with Champaign-Urbana residents who grew up in the Soviet Union and other Eastern Bloc countries, we better hope to understand daily life under communism, Western influence, and resistance movements. This is Back in the USSR, Daily Life in the Soviet Union and Eastern Bloc Nations. I'm Krishna Jaswal.
And I'm Deza Baryshnikov.
In this podcast, we will hear about Eastern Bloc countries' relationship with the West, exploring education, travel, and ideas of what life was like on the other side to better understand the beliefs that the United States and the Soviet Union had about each other.
It was an apartment because we lived in a big city. Everybody lived in apartments. And in the Soviet Union, apartments were assigned by the government. You couldn't just buy or rent whatever you pleased. You were, so to speak, written into an apartment. So you were written into whatever apartment you were born into, or if two people got married, one of them could be written into the other's apartment. So it was complicated bureaucratic arrangements. And a lot of people didn't even live in private apartments, but rather in communal apartments, where you had multiple families actually occupying the same apartment, like one family per room. My family was fortunate in that we did have our own apartments. It had four rooms, and we were six people in it, which by Soviet standards was pretty roomy.
Champaign resident Tanya Ionin, who we just heard from, explained how her family's living arrangement during her childhood reflected housing arrangements during the Soviet times. Ionin spent her childhood in Leningrad, which is now St. Petersburg, during the 1970s and 80s. During Soviet times, many families migrated from the countryside to the cities for new economic opportunities. Under communism, the government owned all housing. While many families in the cities lived in communal apartments with common areas such as kitchens and bathrooms, which were shared with other families in the building, some families, like the Ionins, did have their own apartment. University of Illinois professor Olga Kasina, who also grew up in the Soviet Union, recalls living in an urban apartment as a child and the community that came with it.
I grew up in apartment buildings, so people know each other only limited to one apartment building, and even one part of the building where the apartments in the same stall. You don't know many people outside of your apartment building or your school or your work. But here, because it's more spread out horizontally rather than vertically, you get to know your neighbors in the neighborhood where you live.
Soviet family sizes, especially in urban areas where housing was limited, were often small. Studies have shown a decrease in birth rates during Soviet times. According to the American sociologist and Russian specialist, Professor Jerry Pankhurst, the rate of one-child families was higher in the Soviet Union compared to capitalist countries such as the United States. Professor Valeria Sobol, who grew up in Kyiv, Ukraine, a republic in the Soviet Union, comments on her family size and the reasons behind the trend.
I'm an only child, which is pretty common, actually. You might have heard it from other people. Not the policy like in China, but it was just economically more common. It was just easier. It's a small apartment, sometimes with grandparents in the same apartment, so it was easier for many families just to have one child and be done.
In addition to the government control of housing, under communism, the government also owned all businesses. Michael Andrzejek, who grew up in communist Czechoslovakia, describes how grocery stores operated.
We didn't go very often, actually, probably once a week. and there were no markets, so everything was owned by the state. This was unique in the Czech parts, even of Czechoslovakia, that there was no like private ownership even of small stores, so everything was state-owned.
A Western stereotype about daily life under communism is the image of the breadline, people waiting in line for the hard-to-come-by goods and foods. Several interviewees affirmed this reality through their memories. Champagne resident Elena Zhamin, who grew up in the small town of Pishino, Russia, located about 80 miles from Moscow, recalled such memories.
While it was still Soviet Union and the government regulated economy, there wasn't really like the big assortment, a big variety of goods in stores. There were some goods, of course. There was foods and clothing, but the assortment definitely was not that big. I can say there was a deficiency. When something appeared in the store that, you know, people would like to buy, there would be a line typically because people would hurry to that store to buy that. You kind of need to keep an eye on what appears in the store. In case you want this particular thing, you need to be quick and get there and buy before other people did. It's really, it was a very different than what we see, for example, here in the United States or anywhere else in Western countries.
Similar to Zhamin, Professor Kasina also remembers shortages in Russian markets.
So it depends where you live. I mentioned that my earlier years, we live in a city on the north, like north of Moscow. It had some food issues. Because I remember I loved sour cream. And as a kid, I loved it. They would bring it only certain days of the week. And there would be a line. I was reluctant to be in line for anything else, but I was ready to spend an hour in a line to get sour cream. My grandparents live in this, it's more like west south from Moscow. So every man would be a line, like they would bring meat, there is a line. Sausage, there is a line. Like butter, it's a line. And as a kid, I hated, like I didn't care about butter or sausages. I remember I would always hide when I see that they bring them to the store because they would give only a certain amount of like packages of butter per person. So my grandmother always like, let's go get it like two more, right? Because they didn't bring them every day. And I like, oh, butter is in the store. I better hide because otherwise, like, I will be standing on this long food line. I mean, there was food, but, like, there was some food were more in deficit and there would be lines. That's outside of Moscow. Then when we moved to Moscow, Moscow had everything. Then Soviet time was, like, some cities had it really well and some cities had it not so easy.
Communist countries throughout the Eastern Bloc also experienced these food shortages. Ada Durahemi recounts trying to buy milk in communist Albania.
I remember my first daughter was born in 1987. I didn't have milk to breastfeed her, so we had to buy the milk. But to buy the milk, you had to wake up at 2 a.m. and stay until around 7 a.m. in the line. And you had to wake up at 2 a.m. because otherwise you would be at that point in the line in which there would be no more milk. Both my ex-husband and I had to both wake up very early. And there were two lines. The women and the men were in separate lines. So he would be in the men's line, I would be in the women's line, and wait until the milk would come so that we could secure the milk for the baby because the quantity was measured. But it was for everything. It was lines for potatoes, lines for, like, I don't remember lines for onions, but lines for flour, lines for coffee. We never tried bananas, for example. So there was no line for bananas because I only tried some bananas when I was probably 10 or 12 years old. I remember those came from Cuba, which was a communist country, so they brought us bananas with a shipment. That is the only time for a few months there were bananas. We saw what they were. After that, I had bananas when I left the country when I was 26.
Urbana resident Michael Ondrzejek grew up in Czechoslovakia, a nation which became communist in 1948 after a Soviet-backed coup by the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia. Ondrzejek reflects on his memories of food shopping in the communist Czechoslovakia.
We always had bread, there was meat, there was vegetables, there was seasonal vegetables. Obviously, we didn't have oranges in winter, so... And also, all the food came from the friendly countries. So oranges were only in summer, and they came from Cuba. So I remember we had bananas, but we had bananas for Christmas only. That was very rare. So these, like, exotic food, there were lines for that. You could buy only certain amount of like, apples, I think, and bananas. So I remember the families were usually doing it, like they send different family members to buy more and more. So I remember my mom sent me to buy yet another kilo of something. But it wasn't the basic food. It was like the luxurious.
Communist control of the economy also meant shortages for other material goods. Champagne resident Ihor Zhamin, who grew up in Soviet Ukraine, recalls his limited clothing options.
It was like some model of shorts, and there was only one model in this store. So, like, next day when you go to school or like to play on playground, so everybody had same shirt because it's like only one. This was not choice color or model, just like different sizes and sometimes just two or three sizes. So you buy, and after that your mom should adjust it to your size.
Ada Durhemi recalls a similar experience in communist Albania.
The clothing was very, very hard to get. So most of my clothes were homemade by my grandmother. My aunt was a seamstress, so she also did my dresses, and very, very hard to find shoes. It was very difficult, really. And we had like one pair of sandals, one pair of shoes, one pair of pants, two pullovers. I had a very limited amount of clothing.
Some people tried to get around the shortage of clothes by traveling to other countries to buy clothes, as described by Tanya Ionin, who grew up in Leningrad, Russia, now St. Petersburg.
There was always a shortage of everything, including clothes. So I think for a lot of people, there wasn't that much notion of fashions. You wore what you could get. But nevertheless, I know that a lot of people, women especially, were always trying to get things that would look better. I remember my grandmother actually traveling to Estonia to do clothes shopping because we knew that you could get things in Estonian stores that you couldn't get in Russian stores.
And Michael Andrzejek recalls the shortage of a favorite personal good in Prague, Czechoslovakia.
Did have lines for books, for example. These Thursdays were like the new release day.
This lack of goods often resulted in black markets popping up in communist countries, which in turn created an underground economy. University of Illinois professor Zsuzsa Gila recalls this reality growing up in communist Budapest, Hungary.
Every time you have a shortage economy, people will be resourceful and find some other ways to secure a certain commodity. And then, because it's in shortage, they can get a much higher price for it than it's really worth, or it would be if it were in the stores. So there were black markets. In my early childhood, so 60s, early 70s, this primarily took the form of what here we would call like a flea market. It's a huge open-air area where people just came and sold everything. Later in the 1980s, there were so-called Comic-Con markets. Comic-Con was the economic organization alliance of all the socialist Soviet bloc countries. And this was a kind of tongue-in-cheek name for these little opportunities to shop things because the sellers were often Poles or Russians, and they brought things here that they knew we couldn't buy in stores, and then they would just stand on the street corner, and then you would have to haggle over the price. That was a form of black market that I experienced.
Prague, Czechoslovakia, had similar black markets, according to Michael Andrzejek.
There was a black market for records. Yeah, just so if you wanted to like buy Western music, you had to go somewhere you knew where, and then for a lot of money you just bought some music. That was black market. Black market was, there were these special stores where you can buy either for dollars or German marks or for some special convertible crowns, which were hard to get. And these stores, they were full of, like, you could buy jeans, you could buy some kind of, like, electronics and so on. But that wasn't technically black market. What was black market was actually to convert your own crown currency to this special currency or to Western currency. So that worked as a black market and exchange rate.
Personal connections also helped secure coveted goods as described by Tanya Ionin.
In the Soviet Union, connections were a very big thing. You could get things if you were connected. So if you just take an example, let's say you know somebody who works at a factory that makes nylon pantyhose. So then you could actually might be able to get nylon pantyhose. Whereas if you just go to a store, you probably wouldn't get them. There were always, you know, if you just depended on what's available on the store shelves, you certainly wouldn't be able to think about fashion at all. So you have to have connections. You have to have some ability to get things from beyond what's available on just the store shelves.
Leisure life under communism took many forms, including city-dwelling families seeking relief from urban life during the summer months. Many families would travel to state-owned summer homes in the countryside. Ionin shares her memories of this system.
You ever heard the word dacha? That's like it's a Russian or pre-Soviet tradition, goes to before Soviet times, but it was also popular in the Soviet Union for families to spend their summer somewhere out in the country, by lake, by sea, in a summer home. And some people were able to save up and buy their own tiny little summer homes. Most people, like my family, rented them.
For fun, children growing up in communist countries had interests similar to American children, as described by Valeria Sobol, who grew up in Kyiv, Ukraine.
I was really into reading. I played piano. I took music lessons for 8 years. I did some dance, mostly that. We didn't have theater program like you have here, but we did just our own, a lot of performances that just students themselves produced.
Michael Andrzejek reflects on his interests as a youth growing up in Czechoslovakia.
What young people did, they just did hiking a lot. So we just left on Friday, we just jumped on the train and we went outside and we spent like 3 days outside and we just hiked and slept in the woods, and which was permitted. And so we did that a lot. So this like communal, you take your friends. We were partying, obviously. But hobbies, yeah, reading. It was a lot of reading, sports, going to movies.
Children and teens, of course, also spent a lot of their time in school. The school culture in communist countries provided an opportunity to socialize children to embrace communist ideals. Champaign resident Tanya Ionin, who attended elementary school in Soviet Leningrad, recounts how schools revered Lenin.
So stories about the wonderful Lenin, you know, that was a staple part of childhood education, you know. Children's books about Lenin as a child and what an amazing child he was, and, you know, all the gifts that he gave to his mother and how kind he was to his siblings. And, I mean, he was really venerated. Like, it was raised to the level of religion, I would say, that level of veneration. You know, our amazing grandfather Lenin, pictures of him everywhere, constant propaganda about our wonderful and amazing country.
Another aspect of Soviet schools was its rigid classroom culture and standardized education programs. Professor Baryshnikov shares his memories of the Soviet school curriculum.
In the Soviet Union, the school program was extraordinarily rigid. All schools, like this is a large country, 10, you know, time zones. And in all these schools and whole country, all the kids were learning exactly the same stuff. Same textbooks, same program. The syllabus was exactly the same everywhere. In the so-called national republics, like Ukraine or Kazakhstan, or like that, the national languages will be also learned, you know, Ukrainian and Ukraine, or Romanian and Moldova, and so on. But by and large, again, like literature, math, everything was exactly the same. It was, in some sense, it was good, because when you met somebody, you knew that you read the same books. You know, you could use a reference, and if everybody would understand you. So the people would expect to know exactly the same amount of math.
Professor Ada Deremy also recalls intensive discipline during her school years in communist Albania.
Less freer than here. For example, the way you were evaluated was through what in Italian they call it interrogazione, like as if it is interrogation, the same root as the word interrogation in English, which is not like police interrogation, but you had to get up and stand in front of the whole classroom in the very center of the blackboard and answer any questions that the teacher wanted to ask you. It was some sort of torture. Like, I love talking and I love being in the center, but they were students that hated it. And some of them were very good students. So it's not that they were not prepared to answer, but that position in which you are put in that very, very center of attention bothered them. And that's not right. But there was no way out.
Secondary schooling would become associated with intensive learning. 1980s Soviet Union held pride in its demanding education program, which included requiring advanced courses in math, literature, and ideological history. Professor Sobel shares her memories of school in Soviet Ukraine.
We had very strong math program. We had elements of calculus in high school, and it was required. It wasn't like choice. So basically, when I was taking the GRE, for example, for American graduate school, it covered math, the math part, not the math subject, but the regular covered math from through the eighth grade of the Soviet schools. So it was very good. All the subjects were required. So we had physics, we had chemistry, but for several years. It wasn't as condensed as here. It was kind of spread out more. 4 years of physics, 3 years or 4 years of chemistry, a couple of years of biology, a lot of Russian literature and language, Ukrainian literature and language. All Russian schools had Ukrainian as a subject twice a week. English, didn't learn it so well then. It was in college that I learned it better.
Professor Baryshnikov reflects on the pressure of school in Moscow.
There was quite a bit of pressure. The work was hard. Like pretty rigorous tests. Like you couldn't get to the next grade if you don't pass this test. It was quite a bit of pressure on you.
Education also took place outside of the classroom through the All-Union Leninist Communist League of Youth Organization, starting with the Little Octoberists for young children, the Young Pioneers for preteens, and the Komsomol for teenagers. These government-run youth organizations provided an environment for young people to learn about communist history and ideals. Tanya Ionin recalls her experience as a young pioneer growing up as a child in Soviet Moscow.
Every single child, school child, had to become a young pioneer, actually, at the end of elementary school, at the end of third grade. It was a very big deal. During elementary school, all the little kids were what are called Octoberists, like October children, because of the October Revolution. And we wore a little pin with a little picture of Lenin as a young child. And then when you graduated to pioneers, you got a different pin with Lenin as now an old man, bald and with a beard, and you got a red tie to wear. I think they got that from the Boy and Girl Scout movements. And even though everybody was expected to become a young pioneer upon moving from elementary to middle school, it was a very big deal, I guess probably everywhere, certainly in my school, at what point you got to become a young pioneer. So there was like early admission for the really good kids, the ones who were, you know, very well behaved and classroom leaders. And, you know, we had to vote on them, who are our best kids, who get the, you know, first dibs at becoming young pioneers in, I don't know, let's say February. And then let's say April, I don't remember the exact dates, most of the rest of the class, myself included, you know, the regular kids became young pioneers. But then the bad kids, the troublemakers who got bad grades, ooh, their young pioneering was delayed all the way until May. And so, you know, the Soviet system was very big on this kind of division, right? Identifying who are the good kids, who are the bad kids, putting people in ranks like that. That was a very big thing.
Professor Valeria Sobel recounts the activities held during the pioneer program meetings in Soviet Ukraine.
There were some meetings. We collected like recycling. That wasn't the favorite part. The favorite part was all the creative projects. Sometimes there was like some competitions of like political song, but you had to present it as a kind of almost a skit, also like theatrical way. So that was kind of interesting. But a lot of like, yeah, just meetings and some kind of discussions of politics, which wasn't very really discussion. So
Professor Kasina shares her experience with the young pioneers and how it connected to future opportunities in the Soviet Union.
I was a member of all three. Everybody was. I mean, everybody was Октябрёнок. Everybody was a pioneer. Komsomol becoming more selective, but was not the question not to be in it because you would need to be a member to get into any college. So it was a normal career building.
Professor David Cooper of the Department of Slavic Languages and Literatures at the University of Illinois provides his perspective on the effectiveness of the Soviet Union's education system, despite its other flaws.
One thing that studying this part of the world teaches you is there's a lot of problems with the Soviet Union, right? Serious problems with the incarceration and killing of their own citizens, the ways in which the politics worked, you know, to sort of stifle dissent. On the other hand, there were a number of things that worked well in the Soviet Union, and the drive to equality in maybe different forms than we recognize it was effective in some ways. So education and literacy was quite strong in that part of the world.
Life in the USSR came with its challenges, but was also enduring. From living in communal apartments, to being an only child, to food shortages, to having hobbies like any other kid, to standardized education, all of these aspects capture the unique experience of living in the USSR. These firsthand accounts from Champaign-Urbana residents provide insights into daily life in a communist country. Thank you for listening to Back in the USSR, Daily Life in the Soviet Union and Eastern Bloc Nations, the first episode of Over the Wall, Remembering Life Behind the Iron Curtain, a student-produced podcast by Uni High's Oral History Project team. Each episode in this series focuses on part of the experience of Central Illinois residents who lived in the Soviet Union or other communist Eastern Bloc countries, from daily life experiences to relationships with the West. All interviews featured in this podcast were conducted in spring 2023 by Uni's 8th grade class. If you'd like to listen to more episodes of Over the Wall, Remembering Life Behind the Iron Curtain, check out the WILL website at will.illinois.edu/IllinoisYouthMedia.